are putting everything into this career. And although you want to serve and you want to commit yourself to this path, you find yourself asking questions like, what if I want to change my mind? What if I don't find happiness or joy in this? Today, Dr. Christina Arnold will give us a lesson plan on how to deal with these issues. This is the BioCredible Podcast. Hello, this is Jose from the BioCredible Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. Today, we will have a discussion with Dr. Christina Arnold, an MD graduate of the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas. She obtained her residency training in pathology at the Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore and has held faculty appointments at Johns Hopkins, The Ohio State University, and the University of Colorado. She is a highly talented communicator and has performed multiple talks, dozens throughout the United States and the world, on topics ranging from pathology, clinical versus research, in addition to a lifelong passion for mentoring. She's in fact so talented at mentoring career development that she exited a career in medicine to take on a full-time role as a coach. Today, she shares with us her wisdom on the BioCredible Podcast. What follows is an unedited conversation that I had with Dr. Christina Arnold, and following this conversation, I will close with some of my own thoughts. I hope you enjoy. All right, Christina, thank you so much for joining and being part of this BioCredible Podcast to share your journey. I wanted to kind of just let the audience know, I actually know you professionally. We used to work together at the same organization. And when you went off to Colorado, we really didn't touch base. And then I found that you're doing a lot of this coaching. And I found that to be very interesting. And but also, I'm quite ignorant about what that career entails. And if you could kind of share with the audience, what is it that you're doing? What types of problems do you solve for people?
Well, thank you for inviting me. I love what you're doing here. I think it's such a nice blend of practical advice from someone who's seasoned in the field and also just like what no one else is really talking about. So I love what you're doing with your podcast.
Oh, thanks.
And for your listeners, we went on a recruiting dinner. I just remember it was like yesterday going yes. to the steakhouse after the meeting. It was so fun. And so I'm glad we've been able to reconnect. Mm-hmm. So I'm a full-time coach now, and what that involves is I mainly work with physicians who come to me. Most of them are through feeling burnt out in their career, maybe even thinking of leaving medicine. And what we work on is how to create more happiness in their life.
I see. That's such a subjective end goal, right? And so how do you go about identifying what is unhappy in their current situation that's maybe leading them to burnt out versus, changing altogether and so forth? Like, what are some of the thought processes
Is a really common question is people will say, how do I know? How will I know if it works for me? Mm-hmm. Which almost, it reveals that they don't quite understand. And this is common for people in academics, not understand that they just get to decide, am I happier now? Am I feeling better now? They get to make that decision, which is a really powerful place. I think medicine doesn't teach us to make our own decisions. It teaches us to be stressed about our annual review. What will the chair say? What will the vice chair say? Will I get my bonus? Yeah. And it puts all of our value outside of ourselves, which has us at the effect of the world versus championing what we actually want. And so how coaching helps get there, I guess if I were to define it, it's increasing awareness so we know what we want mm-hmm. again. So mm-hmm. it becomes clear, what are our own expectations for ourselves? How do we get aligned with them? What can mm-hmm. we be doing next to get one step closer to happy?
I see. Now, if I were to just look at your CV and not know you, I would be kind of surprised about this emphasis in your career, but I actually did know you. And although I wasn't really involved in
for example, the pathology student interest group and so forth. I knew that you were very heavily involved in aspects of mentoring when we were working in the same organization. And so what I think would be really interesting is to kind of understand at what point, what was going in your head when you thought my interests and passions could be better served in this venue? What were the kind of the thought processes going on?
I love this question. And I thought I love that you sent it to me in advance so I could really mull it over. And I was like, when did I first get in the bug for mentoring-ish, mm-hmm. like this mm-hmm. world? And I remembered that my earliest memories in high school, I was invited to be a peer counselor. Mm-hmm. And I just loved it. So we spent all day training how to work through conflict, you know, mm-hmm. the I statements, the sandwich feedback, which in high school was just fantastic. And it was just so genius back then because the principals identified, you know, who's going to find out who's in distress first. It's the students uh-huh. versus yeah. the teacher. And uh-huh. so how great to empower students with these conflict resolution techniques. So that's where it all started. And I think just one step led to the other. I loved it so much. I found other ways to create opportunities for it. Mm-hmm. And then at some point I got to this, this was not an easy decision at all. There was a sure. lot of tears. There was a lot of struggle and resistance
yeah.
and there was a lot going on for me to get to this point, but the crux of the matter is I got to this point where I was going to have to choose that. I was either going to stay in academics or I was going to leave, but I had run out of all of my time. Like there was no more time I could steal from this or steal for that. And so I started to see, okay, if I have to make a choice and the time is limited, which way do I want to go? And what really helped me was understanding I'm going to be successful either way. There's no option where I become a failure or become ruined. I'm going to be successful either way. How do I want to spend my one mm-hmm. precious life? Mm-hmm. And the answer became very clear the more I sat with it. I will be successful either way.
Mm, I see. Now that mindset of I can be successful, were you focusing more on achieving kind of short-term, let's say, kitchen table goals and in the sense that, oh, I will be able to support my family, obtain my financial objectives either way? Or was this more of an intangible kind of concept of success? What were you focusing more on?
Yeah. So for me, there was no way I was ever going to choose anything that put my financial goals, my family's livelihood mm-hmm. at stake. Okay. So this was not even a question I entertained until I saw that my income in coaching had succeeded my income in medicine.
Okay.
And at that point, I started thinking, well, where am I of most use to the world? Where do I feel most aligned? Where do I feel most happy? Mm-hmm. Where am I mm-hmm. making the greatest impact? And I think for most people, their answer will be staying in medicine. For the majority, 95% mm-hmm. of people will choose medicine. And I think it's a beautiful choice. For me, maybe I'm the unicorn. There was another choice for me.
Yeah,
I would never have guessed that was a choice I would have made, but it doesn't happen overnight, right? It happens like yeah. in stages.
Yeah. And so the, so here you're at this point, you've shown that you can succeed financially. That's a minimum criteria here, right? That you can mm-hmm. actually continue to make a living. And there's this other question of, it seems like it's broaching into purpose and like life purpose, life passion, and so forth. I think a lot of people would be experiencing doubt. And so, what types of things did you rely on, either people or ways of thinking that kept you positive and something that on the surface seemed very different, although you'd have been manifesting it for so long? But kind of knowing that you'd be successful at that you actually are making an impact on people. What were those types of things, feelings like?
So what's really interesting is, yes, you're right. There was for sure doubt, but I think what's interesting, there was doubt either way. So whether you're in traditional medicine or you're out of it, your human brain will always offer you doubt. I just mm-hmm. didn't use it against myself.
I see.
So what it sounded like for me is, of course, I'm doubting myself. I'm leaving medicine. I've been in it 22 years.
Yeah.
Of course, I'm doubting myself. And also, if I stay in medicine, I will also doubt myself. I for sure had doubts. None of the thoughts I've had as a coach were unique to a coach. They were all the thoughts I had when I was in academics too. Mm-hmm. So then it became, if I'm going to be having this doubt with me, what arena do I want to be in while I work mm-hmm. through the doubt?
I see. Okay. That's really interesting. So one of the things that I think is common with trainees and junior people during really at many stages in their life is they'll have these branch points about what they want to do in their career or specific phases. And, you know, at times it could be that it was the right decision at the time, given the information and the passions of the moment. But it might be, looking back, someone might say, oh, I did all of this and maybe I should stick with that. Maybe I should be compelled to, I feel compelled to continue with something because I've already done so much. And so when I look at what you've done, I see these really interesting branch points. So there's branch points of deciding to go to grad school. There's branch points from deciding, do I do a postdoc or go to residency? You know, all of these branch points that occur. And so if we went back in time to some of the earlier branch points, what were some of the thought processes that were going on in your mind? And I'd be very interested in seeing how those thought processes matured as your career went on.
So this is a really remarkable pattern I've identified, is that as I coach mainly women, not all women, but mainly women. And I have noticed this myself, and then it's been articulated in the people I coach, who they'll say, you know, there was a point in my life where I was fearless and I just did what I want and I didn't apologize for it. And I just went out and got it. And for most of us, that's like, for me, it was age 8. Some people was 13. I mean, these are young years, but we remember that freedom.
Yes.
And it doesn't go away. But we get a little disconnected the further we go, with mom mm-hmm. saying, well, you need to be nice. You need to smile more. And we just have we're layered on with all these expectations from our college professors, med students, our mentors, our chairs. Mm-hmm. And every layer that comes on, it can be easy sometimes to get disconnected from from that version of us who was fearless. And so I think if I were to describe what coaching is, it's about getting back to that version of us. Mm-hmm. For me, when I was 20, I decided I wanted to do an MD-PhD. And when I was 23, I decided I didn't want that anymore. And it was also similarly a painful identity shift to say that I was going to shift gears. It wasn't a pleasant experience because I had these expectations for myself. But also I feel like it was like shedding this layer of what I thought I wanted when I was 20 before I'd been in the lab for 3 years mm-hmm. Once I had new data points, I had a different experience and now I was making a different choice. Mm-hmm. And so the more I could understand myself that I'm always making the best choice in the moment, I just get new data points and new experiences mm-hmm. and new perspectives and things start shifting. And then I get the opportunity to make a whole nother choice if I want to. Mm-hmm. I would give the advice to your audience to love your reasons. The reason, and I've said this myself, but I've already invested so much time in this relationship, in this car, in this choice. Yeah. Be very careful with that reason. It's for me at least, it doesn't feel great. It feels like a burden and not responsibility. It feels very heavy to me. Because mm-hmm. I have done this, I should continue. It ignores what I really want, my agency, what makes me happy. And those mm-hmm. things I don't want to ever let go of.
I see. So I think that's a really interesting balance, right? You raise some concepts of responsibility, of passion. One teaching that I've experienced and has resonated with me a bit that's maybe a little bit distinct from what you're saying, it has to do with purpose in life. And one of the specific teaching I'm referring to is, and this might be more of a cultural background type thing, is one cannot have purpose without taking on responsibility. They're highly linked, the two of them. And so as you're searching for purpose, you know, you're taking on these responsibilities. But then at some point, it becomes about the responsibility and not the purpose. And I think that that is kind of something where I've experienced at times this disconnect. I think it would be very interesting to explore what was it in the lab when you were finding your purpose, that you were just having these responsibilities and you're deviating from your purpose, your goals, and things that you thought were, that you felt were going to result in a fulfillment in your life.
Yeah, that's such a deep question. I love it. This is such a Jose Otero question. I would expect nothing less, by the way. What I would, how I received it is, I mean, I love that concept of purpose and responsibility. It's responsibility to who? And it went from shifting from responsibility to my mentors and societal's expectations and the med school's expectations and my MD-PhD's expectations, my husband's expectations, to responsibility to my happiness and to myself first, above everyone else. When I put myself first, it helped me make decisions. It didn't mean the decisions weren't sometimes painful and hard, because they really were. But it meant that I was going to be responsible to me first.
I see. I think that's a very, very important point. One can't. The ultimate responsibility, the second part of that teaching I was always emphasizes, one has to be responsible to themselves before they can be responsible to others. And I think that sometimes we lose track of that. You know, as we look at what's going on in training, one of the big frustrations that I see people experiencing are there's this curriculum or program or some type of thing that exists that I think every single person honestly will, if you have an honest conversation, will say that much of it is unnecessary, yet we do it for certain types of regulatory reasons and so forth. And I think that confusing that burden with a burden of a career, right? I think that could be two different issues. So let's say if we have a situation where there's how does one determine, like, how can one begin to frame a workflow for themselves and identify, am I frustrated with what the career is doing or with the process of obtaining the certification that I'm needed to do? I think that's a pretty common thing that I've seen. Have you have any thoughts on that?
Do you have an example that I could chew on?
So, sure, absolutely. So an example would be, so when I was a resident, I needed to do certain rotations. Even though I went to a very prestigious program, half of my residency were in hospitals that were like a VA or a public county hospital. I learned nothing. I literally was just a scribe. I was just a body, didn't learn a thing. But I knew that I needed to be there to count towards my residency training. I couldn't just like opt out. And I had to come to the determination, am I upset about the career path or am I upset about this storm? And so I found many times, is this a question of I'm weathering a storm, or is there a bigger issue here? I think that those are kind of things that I've seen many times.
That's so interesting. Yes, I relate to this. So I'm thinking HIPAA compliance training, IRB stuff.
Yes.
Like
yes.
That part of stuff. So this is interesting. Okay. I will want to say that there's so many layers to this. Is it the career or is it the process? It could also be both. We want to make room for that.
Sure.
And something that that was really one of the first fundamental shifts for me in coaching is I had this idea that everything was supposed to be, I mean, it sounds very illogical, but I think most people will agree. The idea we should always be shooting for happiness and happy days. And so whenever I wasn't happy, it was very distressing that I did something wrong. I'm in the wrong job. My boss doesn't care for me. This is all terrible is where I would go for that. Versus in coaching, the idea is life is 50-50. So half of life is going to be easy and fun, and half of life is going to be a struggle. And so for your example, there is this concept, like this might be the playing out of life, the residency being 50-50. It's very prestigious. It opens up all jobs in the world. Everyone wants you at their institution. It opens up so many doors. Amazing. But not every moment will be amazing. And there will be about half of those moments where you're like, why am I even here? What purpose does this serve? And our job there for ourselves is to realize we are in the full expression of the human experience, which is not always going to be positive. It doesn't have to be a problem. And here's where it can be really helpful, especially if you have students listening or trainees listening, is where I would coach on is then why are you doing it? If you don't like this rotation, why are you doing it? So go ahead and answer that for the listeners. You're doing it because?
Are you asking me? Like,
what, the VA rotation?
Yeah. So, I mean, in those cases, I was doing it because I had to do it in order to get certified and finish my residency. There was really no other reason for me.
Yeah. And if, let's say you decided, this is just a hypothetical, but I think it will help because I think there's what I'm tapping into is I think a lot of people in medicine are suffering because we have these thought, I have to, I need to, I'm forced, yeah. I don't have any choice. Yeah. But let's just say you woke up one day and you said, I am not going back to the VA ever. I will never go. I don't like it. Then what would have happened?
What would have happened in that case is I would have probably been kicked out of the residency program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I would have just like not been accepted.
Right. And then after you were kicked out, what would have happened?
Well, I've been unemployed and I had to scramble for a living.
Right. And so we actually, so when we can see, we actually, no one's forcing us to do the HIPAA compliance. We don't like doing it and we do it because we want to stay in this residency program because we know what will be on the other side of this. And so in fact, we start tapping into and exercising this muscle. I don't like this and I get it and I'm not wrong for it. And there's this larger win I'm pulling for. This thing is one unpleasant step in terms of a larger thing I want to get done. Mm-hmm. I am actually choosing it. And now we get to think, okay, if I'm choosing it, there's this larger thing. How do I make this a little bit easier on myself? Mm-hmm. And part of making it easier is allowing yourself to hate it. Or whatever, frustrated by annoyed, as long as you are, and not make yourself wrong there.
Yeah.
I think it's the difference between I have to and I'm choosing this.
Yeah. I think it's just going through that exercise really made me think and kind of play out the options and so forth, kind of going back in time to when I was. That's very interesting and very helpful advice. You know, similar to that concept is, you know, for many of us who are in healthcare or biomedical science or train in both, a constant mantra that you hear from your superiors, your advisors, your program directors is this notion of pipeline, which I've communicated to you before that I really dislike because the analogy, of course, is that there's a pipe that is going somewhere and that inevitably pipes leak. But you want to prevent the leakage, and the only optimal outcome is for the water to get to where the pipe is ending. And although I can understand it coming from government, if there's a government plan saying, oh, well, we anticipate we need so many pediatricians or so many geriatricians by 2040, and we have to generate that as a society, I can understand it in this context. But when I found this to be actually a lot of pressure in the way it's communicated to students, to trainees, because it really does make you feel like things are that there's like this undesirable outcome. Phrases I've heard before is like, the path of the physician scientist is littered with people who don't make it. Like that was recently told to me by a colleague about 3 months ago. And so the question comes in like, well, don't make it. What do you mean by don't make it? I found that statements like that are actually quite harmful for trainees. And so I want to get your perspectives on that and also your how you would suggest dealing with these types of thoughts.
Yeah. What did you come up with? What is your, when your colleague said don't make it, what is he or she referring to?
I imagine that they are referring to a person in an academic organization funded by a competitive federal grant, be it DOD or NIH. That's what I imagine they're talking about.
Yeah. And what do you suppose happens to those people?
Well, most of them probably end up either changing careers or changing directions or focusing on a livelihood that doesn't include that type of work.
Yeah. So it's this all about perspective, right? So someone who has maybe an academic position with NIH funding, their view of making it is looking like them, which is an academic position with NIH funding. Mm-hmm. But those people who don't, you know, in quotes, make it, they don't fall off the edge of the planet. They go on and create something for themselves. And they may, in fact, if you depend on how you're looking at it, be making it in the way that's uniquely positive and beneficial to them. Mm-hmm. Not everyone's goal. I mean, there's a bent probably for your listeners, but not everyone's goal is to be in academia earning grants. Mm-hmm. There's mm-hmm. a million ways to be successful. And what if there was just space for everyone? It does. I want to also, like, this other piece of coaching is this idea that there might be some place, you might make some career choice where no one has anything negative to say. That would be amazing. And I don't think that's on planet Earth. Right? It'd be so good if everyone's like, yeah, she made the right choice. She's obviously doing the right thing. And also, that's just never going to happen. And so then we just get to come back to, okay, so knowing that no matter what we do will not be enough for everyone. What is it that we want to do? For some mm-hmm. people, it's in academics, and others, it's not.
Yeah. And so I think what would be interesting is to get your thoughts on how does one identify the type when an advice, because as a trainee, you're looking at people, you have a lot of respect for them. You're looking up to some of these mentors. And in some cases, it's easy to identify when the mentor's advice is, let's say, incongruent with your values or whatnot. But other times it's challenging. And I think some tools would be very useful to identify, oh, this is coming from a biased person or a biased perspective. And I shouldn't let this be something that affects my identity.
Oh my gosh. So good. Yes. I mean, if I could go back in time and tell my younger self, This is a big question, and I think medicine academics, really, it assumes your value equals your grant funding. Your values equals your papers in Cell Science and Nature. Yeah. Your value is, like, how big is your office? It's all of these things that really essentially have nothing to do with your value. But as long as we are trapped into that, or we're thinking our value is based on these things, it has us chasing other people's approval all of our lives. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's good. I think for your scientist audience to just remember, we want to be investigating everything, even our mentor's advice. Mm-hmm. And I'll say, so many people who I coach, they come up, well, my boss told me this, so this is obviously true, Christina. I was like, wait. We actually get a chance to investigate those thoughts. Yeah. And they might be true for the mentor, but doesn't necessarily mean they're true for us. So the analogy I use for trainees is, imagine you're at a dinner and someone's walking around with a platter of thoughts and opinions. You don't have to take them all just because you're who's holding them. Mm-hmm. You do really get to choose which thoughts I'm integrating, which thoughts I'm accepting, and which thoughts I'm just leaving on the platter. You can do it in a respectful way. You don't even have to tell someone you disagree if you feel uncomfortable or unsafe, but you do get to choose what you want to believe. Mm-hmm. And it will start with something that I teach, I think is really just a fundamental tool that might help your people, is that our value is 100% the day we were born. It's just 100%. It doesn't increase when we get funding, and it doesn't decrease if we lose funding. It's always 100%. And as when you truly know that, it starts liberating you from the decisions you're making. It starts separating you from the decisions you're making. And what I usually hear at this point, your listeners might be thinking this, but if I de-link my value from what I'm doing, maybe I won't do anything ever again. And here's the truth. Science shows, there's publications on there, when we de-link our value, we create even more than we thought was possible. We create so much more. When we tend to think we are only a good doctor if we do X, Y, and Z, we usually wind up giving. We'll still create because we're brilliant people. We have an enormous capacity, but it's really a fraction of what we're capable of as long as our value is attached to it. Mm-hmm. So your question is, how do you know if this is a thought to believe or not? When it's coming from someone you respect, what I would use is, how does it feel? So if you put that thought on and you feel a deep sense of shame and judgment, I would say, I don't care who says it. This is not a thought to practice. We just get to pick what we believe.
Yeah.
Also align it with, what are the results you're trying to create? Is this thought getting you closer or further from the person you're trying to become? So your feelings and the results.
I see. I mean, I remember feeling multiple times when I was being told something, usually a form of, I felt like I was being manipulated. I wouldn't say shame ever came up, but I could see, like, okay, this person wants me to stay in the lab for another year. Okay. Or this person wants me to do this for another year, or commit to work at a part in a particular rotation. Mm-hmm. So for me, the types of feelings, you're talking about feelings, the type of feelings I would usually come up was feelings of manipulation, or having, like, almost kind of like I was being sold a car, actually, you know, and so that was one of the things that I experienced, you know, in that.
So paying attention to that would be like, I'm feeling manipulated here. So there's at least a danger warning sign here. I want to investigate these thoughts.
Yeah.
And also, like, where the coaching piece on that would be, like, what if you could never be manipulated? They're going to say and do things. So, for example, in this situation, a PI wants you to stay longer is kind of the thought. You could look at it as, of course they want me to stay forever. I'm really good at this. They get to pay a lower salary because I'm not faculty yet or whatever. Of course they want me here. Mm-hmm. And I can't be manipulated. I still get to make my choice.
Yeah. I think that's very important advice. I think the fear that many people have, especially when they're in a competitive residency program or whatnot, is the fear of replacement, right? So I certainly felt when I was doing after residency, I did a short postdoctoral fellowship. I certainly felt that I was easily replaced, right? And I don't know how much that was really imposter syndrome and insecurity versus the fact that I was in a position that many people were applying to. I actually kind of knew that the advisor would say almost every day, oh, I got another, you know, just in passing, another application for a postdoc or something like that. And so there might be real issues of job security versus imposter syndrome. How can we tease this out a bit more and to make a better decision?
These are such common thoughts in medicine, for sure, that we could just be replaced. So how does that impact then your decision making when you're thinking that?
Exactly. So it would impact me in the sense that I would have to tolerate certain things and move forward with, kind of be more compliant with what in this case the advisor would be asking me.
Yeah. And so we want to look at that, like, even if it feels, our brain kind of believes that it's true, if we look at what it creates for ourselves, tolerance of being mistreated or going against our values or stepping back from our goals, that's a thought we're going to want to question. And so where medicine does tell us we're all replaceable, and we see examples of it. Someone faculty leaves, the next day someone else is in there. So we see examples of that. We also want to remember, I mean, there is also truth and we're not replaceable. Like, finding truth in that in coaching would be, okay, they can put another body here, but it will never be exactly me. Mm-hmm. And even if I'm replaced, my story doesn't end here. I continue to make choices. I continue to operate in the world. I find a different place, maybe even a better place.
Yeah. I think that would be a very much more healthier way of handling it than the way I did when I was a postdoc, which was to just work harder and try to make a productivity case, as opposed to a, I think what you're getting at is a value a creativeness space that you bring that no one else can replace. For me, I ended up defaulting to a more primitive solution, which was like, well, I'll make sure that I do more Western blots and cell culture than everybody else or something like that, which really creeped and affected my personal life a lot. So your technique would have been definitely much better.
And I want to just make an insert, because I think most people in medicine think the answer to everything is work harder. And I don't want anyone to walk away from this podcast thinking, oh, I have this. This is a more primitive thought. This is not as elevated. Because if we were to investigate it and we went back in time about why you decided to do a Western blot, like what you knew at the time, that made a lot of sense. And so the more we can just drop into understanding, okay, I was doing what I thought was the best. We can just kind of understand ourselves from that place. It gives us more freedom to make other choices in the future.
That's a very nice thought. I appreciate that. You know, I wanted to transition a little bit to a surprising topic that as I was preparing for this podcast, you know, I was, you know, looking at the literature on mentoring, kind of doing some research, and I started searching up joy, and joy in life, joy in work. And I was really struck by how common mentoring is talked about in careers. Joy is not. And when you start looking it up, you end up actually broaching into a lot of religious, spiritual kind of thought, and so forth. And if I may, I wanted to kind of read some of these interesting quotes that I found. And so one of them, now this is coming from someone who's not, I have no expertise in Hinduism. I got this off of a website called the Chaplaincy Institute, but it really struck me. And it says, "O Lord, may we attain the everlasting consciousness of supreme light and joy. May we resolve to dedicate our life to the service of humankind and uplift them to divinity." And what really struck me is that the sage who wrote this really is connecting the concept of joy with service to others. I thought that was very interesting because that connection resonates with me. I do feel that. And, you know, I wanted to get your thoughts on that connection, you know, if you see that in your practice as coach, that maybe we need more of that.
Yes, exactly. So here's the thing, and I'm going to rely on studies in clinical psychology, is that when we're coaching looks at this as well. When we're me focused, I am suffering, I am in pain. Like that's where the pain can get very, very intense. Mm. And so a common technique in clinical psychology is to do distancing, which has become other focused. Mm-hmm. Which is to be in service of others. Like there's really nothing that will help you feel better faster than when you are in service of others. It's just this natural human instinct. There's lots of ways to get distance. I think in service of others is a really important one, especially for anyone in biomedical sciences or medicine. It's just something that taps into our inherent skills. But there's also, I'd like to just mentally go to this place that it might even take less, because if someone's in extreme burnout, volunteerism is not on their list of things to do.
Of course, yeah.
But we can get distancing in our mind. We can try time travel in our mind. So something, a very helpful tool that people often resonate with pretty quickly is, all right, I'm in distress over this Western blot. I feel like my career is over. And let me just time travel to the version of me who's 70, who's looking back at her whole career. And what wisdom does my 70-year-old self have and drawing wisdom from her? Or going back to our 7-year-old self, who doesn't even know what a Western blot is, who sees like, that's kind of cool. You know how to do a Western blot. And just kind of getting that mental distance from our younger self or our older self can start creating some space for us to put things in perspective. Or another technique, they call this the Batman effect in clinical psychology, is where you go into the identity of somebody else, maybe a superhero. For me, it's Oprah. I'm always like, what would Oprah do right now? Which always works for me. It gives me a little chuckle. And it kind of like, Oprah would not be stressed about this. Yeah. But where it's pointing to is in the present moment when we're self-focused, which is where our brain will always be, it will make distress so much more painful. So we want to employ coaching or clinical psychology or these other adaptive tools to start getting distance and perspective so that we can make choices in service of ourselves.
I see. That's very, very interesting. You know, I certainly found this to be a very big problem in my own career. As I've gone through different phases, I've always felt that I've lost autonomy in a lot of things that I do. And I find that part of it, I think, is just because of that's the way medicine is. We need to rely on other colleagues, the patient experience is multimodal and so forth. And I discovered that I can tolerate a loss of my autonomy if I'm buying into a common mission. Like I can kind of, like I found this to be a little bit more like kind of, if I lose this, well, maybe if I'm feeling integrated into the patient service or the mission of the organization, I feel that's okay. You know, I think I can counterbalance that from my own perspective. Another quote that I thought was, that really resonated with me.
Could I insert one thing into that?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. So here's what, and how it will present for most people in coaching is they'll say, I'm jealous of, and not like what you, I'm going to draw on what you said, but also it sometimes presents as people saying, I'm behind where I should be. I should be further ahead. This person has it easier. I'm feeling jealous of this coworker. And what we're noticing here is that tension is coming and most people will shut it down or feel terrible or feel like they're in the wrong job. Versus in coaching, what I like to say is like, this is a mirror of what you want. What you want is autonomy. Now you're telling yourself you'll be okay giving it up if you have this other thing. But what if what we can work on is how can we create autonomy where you are? Or if someone's jealous of a coworker, her science is getting more recognition. Okay, what's happening is you're not really jealous of her. You're wanting more academic success. And we could look at her as an example of what's possible. And then instead of diverting our energy into I'm jealous of her and I'm bad and I shouldn't feel this way and she should not have as she has more support than me. What if we direct all that time and energy back to ourselves and creating these goals that we want?
I think it's a very productive way of looking at it. I remember reading a book about a physicist who later on left physics to become a quantitative finance person on Wall Street. And he had made a comment that was very funny about it. He's mentioned that when he was 17, his ambition was to be Einstein. And then when by the time he was 20, his ambition was some other less prominent physicist. And then by the time he was a postdoc, he merely envied the postdoc on the next cubicle that just got a seminar in France or something like that, So comparing each with each other, I think it's a big problem. So this next quote that I found is interesting. It was an interview by Joseph Ratzinger, who later becomes Pope Benedict the 16th. And the context of what he's saying is the question that was posed to him is, you know, when there's so much suffering around, is it okay to feel joy when there's so much suffering? And so his response, I thought, was just really interesting. He mentions, quote, something I constantly notice is that unembarrassed joy has become rarer. Joy today is increasingly saddled with moral and ideological burdens. The loss of joy does not make the world better. And conversely, refusing joy for the sake of suffering does not help those who suffer. The contrary is true. The world needs people who discover the good, who rejoice in it, and thereby derive the impetus and courage to do good. Joy, then, does not break with solidarity. When it is the right kind of joy, when it is not egotistic, when it comes from the perception of the good, then it wants to communicate itself and it gets passed on. I thought that the notion that really resonated with me is the notion of embracing, feeling okay that you can experience this and that can actually spread somehow. I thought that was very interesting. And I've experienced that in my personal life. And I wanted to get your perspective on that for people bringing that into their careers.
Yeah, that's such an interesting quote. So I relate to this too, where people are feeling guilty that they're having a good a celebration when someone else is not and struggling. And where that gets to, I think, in medicine is a very common for this zero sum game, this idea there's only so much joy. So if she gets some, I get less. If I get more, they get less. When really what's happening is there's not a limit on joy and there's not a limit on suffering either.
That's true.
that we could all have some. And I'd rather have like this concept of a rising tide lifts all boats. Mm-hmm. Once it becomes possible, and like I think there was a 4-minute before someone ran the 4-minute mile, no one thought it was possible. And then someone mm-hmm. did, and then someone yeah. else did, and then someone sure. else did. Right. So it's the idea of just like looking at this possibility of if you're suffering, my suffering won't help you. My suffering doesn't take your suffering away. It just adds twice as much suffering in the world. Mm-hmm. So I have the option of also saying, perhaps joy, if it's available to me, is the choice for me. I'm not always going to be in joy, just like you're not always going to suffer. But there's a space for all of it. And it kind of comes back to this concept we talked at the beginning about life being 50-50. We're mm-hmm. always going to be in one, and we're always going to be moving. This is just a trans, this is a kind of like a wave throughout a cycle. We won't always be suffering, but we won't always be in joy either. And mm-hmm. so really just coming back to ourselves, where are we right now? And what if that's enough? And us being ourselves and creating that relief and ease and sometimes joy, yeah, that can be contagious too. That can help yeah. with other people.
Yeah, it, what you're saying is very similar to my last quote that I found from a Jewish writer, Eli Landes, which I thought was so very uplifting and very similar to what you said, which is that joy isn't just something to embrace even in difficult times, but something that actually has the power to change our situation. I thought that was very beautiful and very hopeful. And so mm-hmm. as if you had a chance, Christina, to be in front of an audience of burnt out physicians who needed more joy in their personal and professional lives, how would you try to convince them that they've got to embrace joy and that could actually change their situation?
Yeah, I would start by not telling them they have to embrace joy. As good as it sounds, imagine you yeah. are a burnt out physician. And here's the facts. 25% of physicians have clinical depression. Up to 50 to 75% have colloquial depression. 1 in 10 are thought about committing suicide. These are the facts. And if you mm-hmm. add on to that and you need to embrace joy too, it's just, by the way, what they're saying to themselves. It just creates so much more pressure.
Sure.
So instead, I would say, embrace what you're feeling right now. You are not wrong either way. And in any moment, you can change everything because your brain is that powerful.
Well, very wise words. And I think with that, I think we'll close up our session here. But this was just so inspirational. And, you know, I've learned a lot with the advice that you've given and that, and especially that last statement. So any last piece of advice for the trainees in the audience?
The last piece of advice is what I was thinking is, what would I tell myself way back when I was an MD PhD and I was really struggling? And I only learned recently, and it really changed everything for me, is I learned that I don't have to believe everything my brain offers me. I used to think whatever my brain offers is for sure the truth because it's my brain. Hello. And then I learned, actually, I get to choose on purpose what I believe. I get to manage my brain. I get to direct my brain to where I want to go versus letting my brain direct me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. Very wise words. And again, thank you so much for coming and joining and sharing your knowledge and wisdom with us.
Thank you, Jose. I really appreciate being here. It's an honor.
That was an outstanding interview. I learned so much from Christina and her wisdom. If you enjoyed this content or other content we've generated, please subscribe, tell your friends about it, because that's the way podcasts grow. In order to create more content, we do need your support, and you can do so by visiting our e-store, biocredibly.com, where we sell merchandise that contains biomedically inspired art obtained from data visualizations performed in the R programming language. Consider supporting me on Patreon and send comments to science@biocredible.ai. That's science@biocredible.ai. As I want to close this podcast, I wanted to close with a couple of thoughts about things that I took away that really made me think. One big concept here that came up again and again had to do, for instance, in the discussion about responsibility. And it's a question of responsibility to whom? And that's so critical, because one of the things that many of us who come into biomedical science or healthcare, we carry this ethos of aspiring to be selfless. That is, the humanistic aspects of the profession we've chosen has been so critical to us and so important in our decision making that it's actually kind of a part of our identity to have this notion of selflessness. And the idea then that something that isn't selfless, well, what's the other option? Well, it must be selfish. And that's absolutely wrong. So we have on one spectrum an act that is selfless, and on this other pole is selfishness. In the middle between those are things that are, maybe you can call it self-care, right? Or focusing on yourself, or however you may want to think about it. But not everything that isn't selfish, not everything that isn't selfless is selfish. You need to find room for self-care. And one of the biggest problems I think that I myself often feel is, well, when is something selfish and when is something self-care? I've struggled with that so much as a person who has experienced, for example, being an academic physician, a family member. I oftentimes focus myself on service to others, and I've oftentimes neglected my own self-care. And that is really bad, because it's not possible to continue servicing others unless you have time for self-care. A final thought revolves around the concept of burnout, which Christina focuses a lot on. Although I completely agree that there's a mental health component to burnout, I don't believe that all of it is due to a mental health illness. That is, not everyone who's feeling burnout requires a mental health pharmaceutical intervention. And much of the burnout, in my own experience, is due to dysfunctional thought processes, dysfunctional cultures, and dysfunctional environments that have just creeped away and gotten out of control. And that's something that a cognitive realignment can really help. And I think that that's some of the positive benefits of what coaches such as Christina Arnold can do. She has so much to say and so much wisdom, and you can check her out at her podcast, Happy in Medicine. I hope you've enjoyed. Until next time.